This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In comparison to other New England states, New Hampshire's medical marijuana system is narrowly structured. Just a select group of patients with certain ailments and symptoms can access the drug. Now, though, there's a renewed push to also allow those with chronic pain to get therapeutic cannabis. It stems from deep concern about an opioid crisis brought on, in part, by prescription painkiller dependence. But some caution that widening the law is premature and could lead to unintended problems. Today in The Exchange, should more Granite Staters have access to medical marijuana or not? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have four guests in studio. Dr. Gil Fanciullo is here, director of the Pain Management Center at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. He's also medical advisor for the Merrimack Marijuana Dispensary. And Dr. Fanciullo, good to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Laura. Good morning.
Also with us, Dr. Stuart Glassman, rehabilitation medicine physician at Granite Physiatry in Concord. He represents the New Hampshire Medical Society on the Therapeutic Cannabis Advisory Council. And Dr. Glassman, welcome back to you, too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Representative Joe LaChance. He's a Republican state rep from Manchester who has supported several bills to broaden the state's medical marijuana law. And Representative LaChance, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Laura.
And last but not least, Tim Mork, Director of Substance Use Disorders Grantmaking at the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, Chair of the Governor's Commission on Substance Use. And Tim, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Laura.
And Dr. Fanciullo, I just want to start with you. Quick reminder, please. Who can get therapeutic cannabis right now in New Hampshire? What are those qualifying conditions and symptoms?
Sure. Patients have to have a three-month relationship with a provider, either a nurse practitioner or a physician, and the provider must have conducted a complete history and physical examination on the patient, and they must have a qualifying medical condition. And it's a relatively limited list. It includes things like Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, multiple sclerosis, and they have to have a symptom. So they have to have severe pain that hasn't responded to other treatments, or they have to have spasticity or cachexia or other symptoms that are enumerated in the law.
So you have to have a condition and a symptom. How unusual
is
that?
That's correct. Well, I haven't done a study of the 25 states in the United States, but it's different in Vermont, for example. So in the state of Vermont, instead of that and, the word is an or. So you have to have either a condition or a medical condition. And even now, they've broadened their law to include just chronic pain.
How much are physicians involved, Dr. Fanciullo, and not involved in this process? For example, from what I understand, doctors don't prescribe medical marijuana. They recommend it? Is that how it works?
Well, we attest to the fact that a patient has a medical condition that qualifies them for medical marijuana in the state of New Hampshire. So we still have DEA licenses that come from the federal government, and our state medical societies have done a good job protecting us in case leadership changes or national opinion changes in a way that might put our DEA licenses at jeopardy. We wouldn't be able to practice medicine without our DEA licenses.
So that's the Drug Enforcement Agency, and the DEA still considers marijuana a Schedule I drug.
That's correct.
In other words, illegal.
That's correct.
So go ahead. You were finishing that thought there on how that kind of works out, where you don't prescribe, but you say, yes, this person
correct
is recommended.
So I complete a form that basically states that the patient – that I have a bona fide physician-patient relationship and that the patient has a medical condition and that the patient has a symptom that are specified in the law.
Well, and I want to bring Dr. Glassman into this too, but one last question for you, Dr. Fanciullo. How much medical education do – marijuana dispensary staff tend to have? I know you're an advisor at the Merrimack one, but I wonder what sort of medical background your typical staff person has.
It varies from state to state. In the state of Connecticut, for example, there has to be a pharmacist on site at all times. In the state of Pennsylvania, there has to be either a pharmacist or a physician on site in their new bill. In the state of New Hampshire, there does not have to be any formal education for the people that recommend cannabis at the dispensaries. And this has been a little bit of a stumbling block for a lot of physicians sending patients to a dispensary because physicians in general don't know very much about medical marijuana. They don't know about the different strains. They don't know about the different routes of administration, et cetera. And so they're a little bit concerned that the people that are making recommendations and dispensing the drug to their patients don't really have any formal training.
That's interesting, Dr. Glassman, given how tight New Hampshire's law is on one end, you know, a short list of qualifying conditions and symptoms. But then on the other end, at the dispensary level, it doesn't seem like there's that much medical oversight knowledge involved.
Well, aside from that, Laura, there's no requirement for physicians or nurse practitioners to have any training on the use of medical marijuana in patients. Other states do have, education requirements in order to certify patients to be able to then obtain the marijuana. So it's not just the dispensaries, but in our state, there is no requirement for providers to have any training whatsoever to certify a patient. So that's important for the listeners to understand. There are 17 diagnoses and 10 symptoms that are part of the program. So, our listeners can go to the Health and Human Services website and see the different current listings of diagnoses and the current symptoms. So it may be limited to some, but it's still, a fair number of diagnoses there.
How do you feel about the way the law is set up now, this sort of narrow structure and then the four dispensaries and so forth?
Well, I think that the entire process, and again, I was appointed to the Therapeutic Cannabis Advisory Council at the beginning and worked with Representative McKay and Michael Holt from the Health and Human Services Department and other representatives and stakeholders. We went slow because we were the last state in New England and we wanted to get it as right as we could, looking at other states and seeing what was happening around the country at that time. And I think one of the issues that continually came up was that because, cannabis or marijuana is a Schedule I drug, you can't really do great research because of the fact that it's not available to clinicians to actually do the kind of research you would hope you could have if you're going to talk about having patients have access to it. So I think we went slow on purpose because there were more questions than answers in the entire process. The other thing to understand about the certification by physicians or nurse practitioners is that you don't have to recommend it at all. All you have required to do is explain the health risks and benefits to the patient. You personally, as a clinician, do not have to say, I feel this is in your best interest. All you're really doing is saying, you have a diagnosis, you have a symptom, and I can certify that that is the case. And you don't have to actually say, I feel you have more of a benefit than a risk in this situation. You have to explain those benefits and risks. But as a clinician, you don't have to actually tell your patient that I think you do have more of a chance of a benefit.
So slow and careful, that's how you describe the approach that New Hampshire took toward this law. And as you know now, Dr. Glassman, there's a lot of concern about chronic pain, people turning to opioids, then getting addicted to those opioids, then going to heroin and fentanyl, and so many horrible overdose deaths here in New Hampshire. Do you foresee a time, Dr. Glassman, when chronic pain might be eligible for therapeutic cannabis?
Well, again, I think if there are good enough studies that can support it being one of the choices for treating, acute or chronic pain, then I would hope so. But again, I don't think that the studies are ideal yet for most clinicians to feel comfortable with that.
Well, and Dr. Fanciullo, that seems to be one area where everybody agrees is not enough research out there.
So I would respectfully disagree to some degree anyway. I mean, if you look at studies on neuropathic pain in patients using medical cannabis, there are good studies. The studies that exist are as good as the studies supporting the use of opioids or better than the studies supporting the use of opioids. So I would always say, yes, we need more research. We need to figure out what drug works best for ulcerative colitis, for example, and there's room for research. But if we're looking at two questions, one is, what is the efficacy of the drug in chronic pain? I don't think there's any question that if you review the literature, there's strong medical scientific support for the use of cannabis for chronic pain. And the other question is, if you're looking at studies for safety, we hear a lot of comments that we haven't done small animal studies and we haven't experimented on human beings, but we've done what are called post-marketing surveillance studies. The drugs used by 10% of the population of the United States, essentially, regularly, at least once a month. And so if there were pulmonary hypertension or some other problem that was resulting from the use of this drug, we would have seen it by now.
Well, Representative LaChance, you have a personal experience with chronic pain and the search for some relief. I'd love to get your perspective on this, too.
I do. Thank you for asking. You know, this issue is near and dear to my heart. I'm a veteran of the U.S. Army. I had a back injury. Subsequent surgery, I have permanent nerve damage, and I waited so long to get surgery that I have permanent nerve damage, and the VA put me on opioids, and probably 5 to 6 years taking 5 to 6 oxycodone a day with a 75 milligram fentanyl patch. It was no longer working. And my next stop was heroin. It was, and I did not want to do that.
Wow. So all those painkillers and it still didn't work.
I'm very lucky to be alive today based on what I was taking. And you add a little alcohol to that. I'm very fortunate to come from a great family that helped me out. So that's why I'm so passionate about this. And I get phone calls every day, either email, phone calls that say, please help, please help. I know your story. You're not afraid to tell your story. I'm in a very similar situation. I can come right out on the radio and tell you that cannabis saved my life. It's just that simple. I'm the scientific evidence. You know, why is it easier for me to get OxyContin than something like medical cannabis, which is similar to a tomato plant? Synthetic heroin versus something that grows in the ground, cannabis. I just have a real hard time that our federal government does not let us study this plant. If you look at countries like Israel, Israel has been first and forefront on this issue. They study, and there is a lot of scientific evidence out there that will say that, yeah, not only does it help with chronic pain, but you might actually help yourself get off opioids, or more importantly, what if you never had to get on opioids in the first place? And follow the money. Why is it such a fight for therapeutic cannabis to be embraced in the country? And you have to wonder, at what point does big pharmacy look at this and say, well, if one pill only solves one problem, but they have a plant that can solve 100 problems, well, we're out of business. So, you know, I respect the doctor's views. We just need to do some more studies and take a look at people like myself who have actual experiences, who came close to having a bad incident, and it did save my life. I'm a cannabis card holder. I go to Sanctuary ATC in Plymouth to get my medicine, and I thank God that I found this medicine, because I might not be alive to see my children. So,
well, Tim, I want to bring you into this, too. And there has been a lot of talk lately with the hyper focus on the opioid crisis. I think more than a person a day died last year in New Hampshire from drug overdose. I mean, it's just stunning. How do you feel about this hope that expanding medical cannabis to people with chronic pain could help alleviate the opioid crisis, kind of connecting the dots there?
I think it is I don't think it's an accurate reflection to connect those dots directly. You look at a state like Colorado, which not only has, of course, medical marijuana but expanded social access to marijuana use. Their opiate epidemic is ravaging that state with articles as recently as last week. So there is no one-shot solution here. By the same token, I agree with, I think, a theme that my previous colleagues have spoken about, which is, you know, opiates, which for many patients are clinically indicated and effective and don't cause some of the side effects such as drug-seeking behavior and challenges like the representative experienced, come from the same plant that heroin comes from. But the FDA, we have a process in this country. Adequate research was done. The Food and Drug Administration supported that research. We were able to take the parts of that that source plant and create medications that, while they are causing a problem in our society, even the medical community caution us all collectively, they do serve a purpose and help a significant number of people. And we don't want to reduce access and stigmatize those for whom opiates are the appropriate path of choice. So I agree with the concern that I think part of the challenge we have here is that we have a plant that plant has some iterations of what it produces that is an addictive drug. And you can talk to adolescent treatment centers in the state of Connecticut who are having more referrals for marijuana addiction than they are for opiate addiction right now. So it causes consequences. However, it is the science is emergent that there are clinical benefits. Yet there has been incredible restrictions on the ability to do the kind of authentic research that you would do with other sources that might show promise. And so we have then developed this sort of schism where we have this state-by-state solution to develop, in essence, a siloed pharmaceutical industry outside of the general medical environment. So for me, it's not about suggesting that that expanding access to therapeutic cannabis will alleviate the opiate epidemic is simply not accurate, because there is no one solution to the opiate epidemic. For patients, however, for whom opiates are not effective, we need to have flexibility to look at non-opiate pain relievers. However, marijuana is not the only one. You know, there is work afoot that will come up in the legislature likely this year to look at insurance formularies. There are already on the market non-opiate related pain relievers that very often are not covered by insurance. Can they be covered by insurance so patients can actually access them? Are there studies that can compare non-opiate pain relievers to non-opiate pain relievers and see what that says? I think opiate versus marijuana is sort of the wrong conversation, and I think it digs us into trenches related to those of us who are concerned from a child protection and a drug prevention standpoint, and a community that is saying, wait a minute, there may be some consequences here, but this source plant has some medicinal benefit, we believe, and we need to conduct the same kind of medical research, build the same kind of pharmacological case as we do any other drug in the system, and not do that outside of that medical system.
Do you feel like this argument is building, Tim, that, you know, we could solve one if we expanded the other?
Well, I hear it a lot and it concerns me.
Whether you agree with it or not,
yeah.
It just sounds like
yeah,
you don't.
Yeah, no, I think that argument is building. However, I think, you know, the bigger conversation is non-opiate pain relievers. Do we have them? Are they available? Marijuana, therapeutic cannabis may be one of those that needs to be explored, again, in the context of good medical research like any other medication, so we hold it to the same standard. But I think, again, the idea that the only non-opiate-related pain reliever is marijuana, I think, is just a mischaracterization. It needs to be looked at in context.
Let me remind our listeners that they can join us. The exchange phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And as you're hearing today in the exchange, we're looking at whether to broaden New Hampshire's medical marijuana law, specifically for patients with chronic pain. 1-800-892-6477. Tell us what you think. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dr. Glassman, I can see you want to jump in. Also, Dr. Fanciullo. Go ahead, Dr. Glassman.
So one of the issues that the Therapeutic Cannabis Advisory Council has talked about for the past 2 years was outcome information, outcome data, outcome studies for our program going forward and any other state that has a medical marijuana program. Jim McKay reached out to the National Council of State Legislatures. There were no outcome information at all for any state, the 25 plus District of Columbia, that has a medical marijuana therapeutic cannabis program.
What does that mean, outcome
information?
Outcome.
So in other words, did the program lead to benefits for patients? Did it lead to side effects or other collateral problems, increased traffic accidents as we've seen in Colorado and Washington State, increased emergency room visits for, you know, pediatric patients who somehow got oral extract, you know, that looked like something it wasn't supposed to look like from their parents. In other words, a lot of the studies that are published, and I did a big review over the last couple of days, a lot of the benefits for marijuana use is often in the oral extract form as compared to the smoked form. So again, outcomes let you know if your program is actually helping the community, making a benefit for patients.
Okay, and Dr. Glass, I'll let you jump in after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, ongoing debate over who should access therapeutic cannabis in New Hampshire, specifically whether patients with chronic pain should have access to medical marijuana. Give us a call. Tell us what you think. 1-800- 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And all of you, before we go to our listeners, Dr. Fanciullo, I know you wanted to jump in there too, just before the break. Go ahead.
Thank you, Laura. So I wanted to make a couple of comments about the substitution of cannabis for opioids. And where cannabis is not a treatment for opioid addiction, there are studies that show, for example, that there's a 25% reduction in opioid-related deaths in states that have medical cannabis. And that number increases with time. So the number of deaths is so much for the first year, and it's more for the second, third, and fourth year. There's also a study that shows that that in states that have medical cannabis, opioid use is reduced by 65%. So medical dispensary patients reduce their use of opioids by 65%.
So you're saying we can connect those dots?
I think we can connect those dots.
Between the opioid abuse epidemic and the lack of availability for medical cannabis for chronic pain sufferers.
You know, it's a correlation and not a cause and effect, you know, thing very specifically. But I think that there's evidence that the use of cannabis does reduce the use of opioids. And the only other thing I want to say, Laura, too, is that in my opinion, you know, cannabis is not for kids except under very rare circumstances. It's not for adolescents. It's not for pregnant women. You shouldn't use the drug while driving. All of those stipulations are extremely important. But for adults who don't have a problem with addiction, who have a medical condition, in my opinion, taking care of these patients, it's a drug that I've been waiting for 30 years in my clinical practice.
Joe LaChance, you want to jump in there?
You know, I'd like to talk a little bit about with Dr. Glassman. He mentioned Colorado and some of the other states and some kids getting a hold of edibles. You know, I think the same responsibility bears true for any type of prescription medication, whether a parent leaves out a bottle of OxyContin or a bottle of blood pressure medicine. This needs to be this program, if you have that medicine, it needs to be in your medicine cabinet, locked up, not access to kids. But if you take a look at Colorado and Washington, recently they went to recreational in addition to therapeutic use. And the research indicates that in Washington, the teen use of cannabis neither increased or decreased. But the interesting part is when you look at Colorado, they actually had a 5% decrease in teen cannabis use. And that's pretty interesting. That's pretty important. And I think what it's doing is you've taken the, for lack of a better word, the sexiness out of the drug because it was illegal and kids would try it. And now we're educating people more, just like we did with cigarettes. We continue to sell less and less cigarettes because we've educated people. We took Joe Camel off. We had lawsuits. There's so many things that we did to educate people about cigarettes that has gone down as well. So I think it's the same concept.
Representative Chance, how do you get around the concern that a lot of people have that expanding medical marijuana is just an excuse for some people to get high? That, you know, okay, I hurt my neck working out yesterday, so now I can go get some medical marijuana.
So I that's a very good question. And, you know, I think you're always going to have abuse with 3% of the population is going to be addicted to something, whether it's alcohol, prescription. So I think you're always going to have some sort of abuse in the system. However, I think the benefits outweigh the harms. And, you know, maybe somebody will get through the system, but there's different types of cannabis you can use. You can use CBDs where you have none of the psychoactive properties for healing. There's so many different ways. So by going to an alternative treatment center, which I'm heading to Prime Alternative, I'm heading up to Sanctuary right after this because we've got Hemp Fest this weekend that starts up in Lancaster. I'm going to go in. I'm going to get some CBD. I'm going to get I have a menu, and I know exactly what's in there.
CBD is a compound.
Yes. Yeah, the non-psychoactive compound in cannabis. So you've heard children who had seizure disorders, they use the Rick Simpson oil. It's a CBD-based oil, and they do not get any psychoactive reaction to it.
Well, that's interesting. And Tim, I did want to ask you about that. We're getting into some of the details now, but I have read that today's medical marijuana, some of it can be bred to have much, much lower levels of the psychoactive compound.
Correct.
So does that make you feel more reassured?
To the extent that there is requirements that call for that, that there are products available through the ATCs that reduce the likelihood of negative childhood child exposure. You know, there is a lot of concern in the prevention field generally. And this is again, the conundrum, I think, even in some of the representative comments. So you have a state that might have had a reduction in general youth marijuana use. Does that have anything to do with whether or not marijuana was legalized or not? We don't know. On the flip side, we know adolescent treatment admissions for THC addiction are skyrocketing in the treatment centers that serve adolescents in that same state. So while less kids may be using recreationally, those that are using are developing substance use disorders based on their routine use of regularly now accessible marijuana with higher levels of THC.
THC, again, is the part that gets you high.
The part that gets you high.
CBD is the part that apparently has the medical benefits.
Correct. And I think there are some emergent signs that there might be some medical benefits to this THC piece too. So that adds to the complexity here because on the one hand, there is this cost-benefit issue, I think, is where we collectively need to struggle the most because there are public health consequences of making things like that more available. We have alternative dispensaries in the state who provide edibles. They're providing things as brownies, butter, food products that could be easily mistaken by a child. Now, are those food products that only are CBD? So if a young child get exposed to them, they don't have the THC in them to cause that kind of reaction. In other states, that's not the case. And we've seen emergency room visits and things like that due to that kind of diversion, whereby there are tinctures and oils, things that are very difficult to divert, would not be just innocuously picked up by a child that science is showing is more effective. But we don't have restrictions in our law at that detail of what you can put on.
Let's go to the phones, gentlemen. I know all of you want to jump back in, but we will go to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Selma's calling from where? Hi, Selma. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Laura. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I wanted just to, I guess, voice my frustration about the availability of medical marijuana in New Hampshire and the restrictive nature that our lawmakers have placed upon what I view as, you know, plant-based medicine that should be available to everyone. So I've suffered from a number of chronic pain conditions over 18 years, and I kind of get new diagnoses every week, and I think I either fall into the chronic Lyme spectrum or the autoimmune spectrum. So it's fibromyalgia, chronic Lyme disease, endometriosis, hypothyroidism, insomnia, a long list of medical conditions. And I could have easily been prescribed opiates or painkillers over this, you know, these many years, but I've used all kinds of other plant-based medicine, herbal medicines, for the inflammation and pain and sleep, and, you know, experimented a lot with what I consider plant-based medicine. And I find it incredibly frustrating that given my long list of conditions, I don't qualify under New Hampshire's definition of eligibility for the medical marijuana.
So you'd love to see if this worked for you, Selma, but so far you're not on that select list.
Exactly. And I also feel that it's highly discriminatory towards women's health because it is mostly women who suffer from autoimmune and these chronic pain disorders, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, et cetera.
Well, Selma, I'm sorry to hear about your struggle. And I wonder, Dr. Glassman, if you've heard from patients like Selma before.
Well, and Selma, you know, again, it's unfortunate that, you know, you've been going through, you know, your conditions and you haven't really gotten the definitive answers to what's causing it. But there is a process where patients and providers can actually petition to the Department of Health and Human Services twice a year request to see if there's coverage for a condition that's not on the list.
For an exception.
Correct. Right. Separate from, going through the legislative process to add other diagnoses as well.
So you and your doc have to separately petition DHHS, Department of Health and Human Services.
Correct.
For that exception,
right.
And then you might be able to get access to it.
Correct.
How often does that happen, Dr. Fantullo?
It happens quite often.
Really?
Yes. And, we have 11 qualifying conditions in the state of New Hampshire. I think that – and I'm not criticizing the state at all because I agree it's a process and we're starting off heading in the right direction. But you can't list medical conditions because, you know, somebody has mucopolysaccharidosis type 3 and has intractable pain. They don't qualify for medical cannabis in the state of New Hampshire. And so really we need to specify symptoms and maybe not conditions because it's impossible to create that list. And yes, fibromyalgia is a common disorder, a whole list of disorders that aren't covered under New Hampshire's law.
Well, here's somebody else who did not want a name used, sent an email, who also says, had fibromyalgia for 13 years. I'm in pain all day, nearly every day. Wow. With all the coverage of opioid abuse, this person says, it may be hard for your listeners to believe that some patients do not suffer from addiction. I believe it bears mentioning that they aren't always addictive. When I used to tell my friends what medication I was on, I would hear the caution about addiction, some even arguing with me that I must be addicted, though my doctor and I agree I am not. I do take the medication nearly every day, but occasionally don't need to take it. And when I don't, I survive just fine without any withdrawal. So again, Tim, here's a person who's saying don't go overboard on this idea that opioids are bad in every single instance.
Right. And I think it's important. And I hear from patients quite a bit who feel that they've been stigmatized around the use of a medication that they feel is working, which is why I think we have to think cautiously and carefully, but about even in the issue of therapeutic cannabis, for patients for whom this is of benefit, how do we build a system to the extent that the science says we should that allows access to it while mitigating the unintended consequences both for the individual patient and the general public as a whole? And that's where I think it's just really important. But we need to do it from a place of understanding that chronic pain is a complex, difficult issue and people need to find the treatment that is best for them. And for some, that does include the safe, perhaps lifelong use of an opiate.
Well, and I do wonder if, getting back to what you said earlier about insurance reform, Tim, if there are other answers to chronic pain that just are so outrageously expensive that people don't even bother considering them.
Well, again, you know, there's going to be some legislative attention, I think, in the next session looking at the idea of non-opiate-related pain relievers.
Such as
Humira is one I know. It's used for rheumatoid arthritis. There's some sense that it does have more broad applications in terms of pain management. I defer to my doctors over here around its efficacy, but it's often not covered by insurance for that indicated purpose. So there is going to be a look at insurance formularies, and to the extent that there are FDA-approved non-opiate-related pain relievers, do patients have appropriate reimbursement to access them? Should their physicians recommend that as a course of treatment?
I can see Representative Chance. Go ahead. You want to jump in earlier.
You know, a couple things. Going back to the phone call from Selma, I get those every day. And what I pledge to the folks out there is to work with the stakeholders right here at the table. And current legislators in a couple weeks can introduce bills. And I want to work with the advisory board. I want to work with the other representatives, the other doctors. It is my intention to add post-traumatic stress disorder. Again, I was not successful with that bill last time. As Dr. Glassman said, the research wasn't there. It still may not be completely there, but we have a better handle on our cannabis program now. I'd like to I introduced a bill instead of having a symptom and a condition, I want a one-word change, or, and that will broaden it for many people. And lastly, I think we need to take a look at the number of alternative treatment centers we have. You know, I think the North Country might be getting shortchanged, and whether that's adding some sort of bill or law to allow them to maybe have a mobile service to the north, you know, up to Colebrook or to Berlin or in that area. I just think that might be something we need to look at.
So this is going to be a priority for you.
For me.
If reelected,
I will work with the stakeholders to continue working as hard as we can. And there was one other thing we had talked about, packaging for edibles. And I think it's very—
That has been a concern.
I think it's very important that this state has done a very good job with their administrative rules and with the advisory council. If you walk into the alternative treatment center, you have the cookie is in a plain foil white type bag with a prescription right on it. You cannot mistake it for states like Colorado, where they actually put gummy bears and they have little pictures
of,
you know, you can understand why kids are getting a hold of that. And frankly, as a legislator, that's irresponsible.
Again, our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Dr. Glassman, go ahead real quick.
Sure. So one of the issues about the process for certification is once you have that 3-month relationship, although you can actually have less than the 3-month relationship if the diagnosis was actually determined less than 3 months ago, you could have a situation where someone doesn't have to wait 3 months to actually get certified. From that point, though, they don't have to go back to see their doctor for a year. So you could have a situation where someone gets certified and they may not go back to their doctor for an entire year. Dr. Fanciullo mentioned one of the studies about opioid use decreasing in states where there was medical marijuana. There was also another study that Medicare expenditures went down as well. But one of the concerns of that study was, will patients potentially not go back to see their doctor for blood pressure, hypertension, other medical issues because they feel that the marijuana will treat all of that? So that's another part of this entire program that came up a number of times during our advisory council meetings, which is we wanted as physicians to be able to see patients every 3 months to follow up. And it was not –
Is it possible they're not coming back sooner because they feel better?
It could, but what I'm saying is that they don't have to come back so that your physician can find out how are you doing. Once they get certified, they walk into the dispensary, whatever product they're going to get is not from their physician's recommendation. It's what they're learning from the dispensaries and their own knowledge as well.
And we talked earlier about sometimes there's a lack of medical training or knowledge among dispensary staff.
Possibly.
Let's go to Dover where Evan is on the line. Hi, Evan. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi, I've been listening for a while, and a lot of this has to do with, I think, whether, doctor should be provided the ability to prescribe marijuana and, how dangerous it is and that sort of thing. And I don't speak from a liberal perspective. I'm captain in Merchant Marine, and, at my level, we're fairly conservative, but this whole thing to me seems like an institutionalized media hypocrisy because I have two sons. They can get marijuana, all kinds of marijuana, on the street, down at UNH, anywhere from Rochester to Portsmouth, anytime. And the only people who have to worry about access to this stuff are the solid middle class who follow the rules. The economic lower class don't worry about it. The upper middle class can buy a doctor's prescription. And as far as I know, there's been no ODs on marijuana. People are using it all the time. I think at least 50% of the kids use it.
So, Evan, if I could interrupt, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm not really sure where you're coming down on this, whether you think medical marijuana should be expanded or not.
I'm saying that the question about whether we give people, doctors, the ability to prescribe this stuff is superfluous. It's out there. It has done no harm. Let's say it even does lead to, more hard drugs. Let's say it does. I mean, there's no solid proof. But if it did, it's everywhere anyhow. You can't stop it. It's there. So why is there all this sort of formal fuss about whether we should prescribe it or whether we should legalize it? It's there. People are using it, and they're not ODing on it as they are.
I see.
Heroin and all the rest of it.
So okay, yeah. Evan, let me jump in on you there, and I apologize, but we're heading into a break. Tim, what do you think? We're getting ourselves all in a fuss, as he puts it, over something that's already out there and doesn't seem to be, causing society to rip apart.
Well, it's a totally probably a separate show in terms of the sort of consequences of recreational use. I mean, I think this idea you hear very often, marijuana is it's not heroin. And there are some, and I share a frustration at the DEA's insistence on keeping marijuana as a Schedule I drug. However, while it is not as dangerous, quote unquote, as heroin, there is still significant public health consequences very akin to alcohol, such as a state trooper who was killed in Massachusetts by someone who walked out of a dispensary, spoke two joints, got behind the wheel of a car. So I think there is a need with all substances to think about policies around expanding access super, super carefully because there are public health consequences that are absolutely certain.
Coming up, more of your questions, comments, and thoughts. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, whether to broaden New Hampshire's medical marijuana law, specifically for people suffering from chronic pain. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. And Dr. Fanciullo, Dr. Glassman, Joe LaChance, Tim Rourke, let's go back to our listeners. Jeffrey's calling from Bradford. Hi, Jeffrey. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning to your guests. And hi, Joe. I'm a representative from Henniker in Bradford. I'm currently in my car. I'm not driving, but I'm listening to the NHPR app on my phone.
So, okay, go ahead.
I felt there's a lot to be said about all this, of course. I just needed to comment about one point that Tim made a couple of times about the addictive data coming out of Connecticut and some other states where young people are being shown to be addictive or having that addiction problems with marijuana. And I just wanted to point out that very often that data comes from the criminal justice system where young people are caught with marijuana, and rather than face time or stiff fines, they will agree to enroll in some of these programs where they've become a statistic for addiction when, in fact, they may not be addicted at all. But it does lead to this argument that somehow marijuana is addictive. And I just wanted to make it clear that that statistic is kind of flawed.
So questioning the addiction statistics, what do you think, Dr. Glassman? Is marijuana an addictive substance?
Well, we know there are certain conditions that come from chronic, marijuana use. Cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome is one of the diagnoses where someone has protracted nausea from marijuana use. We know that the THC content has gone up over the years compared to, 20, 30 years ago when maybe it was 3% THC. Now it's 15, 20% THC.
Again, THC being the high-producing element.
One of the components, right? Exactly. I mean, there are many different compounds within marijuana itself. And again, there are studies that say maybe it's less addictive than alcohol. But again, can you do the studies? If it's a Schedule One, you really can't know how much people are using.
Schedule One means, again, that federal classification, it's illegal and so forth.
And I think you have to, as a clinician, be concerned that your patient and again, there's many other reasons why people get addicted. I think you have to go through the process of assessing is there a risk for your individual patient. But overall, I think it's a question that needs to be looked at in detail for sure.
Well, and Dr. Fantullo, as I said earlier, you are medical advisor at the Merrimack Marijuana Dispensary. What about the marijuana there? Is it bred, so to speak, to have the lower THC content and the higher CBD, which is the therapeutic compound in marijuana?
We have a whole range of different concentrations of THC.
Why would you need THC if you were there for therapeutic health purposes?
People believe that there's an entourage effect with cannabis, and so there are probably 60 cannabinoids in marijuana, and the two most common are THC and CBD. And without the THC, it seems like you don't get the same degree of pain relief. And
so they work together.
They work together. And so we need some THC, we think, in cannabis in order to produce the – and I'm a pain expert – in order to produce pain relief. So we have very low concentrations of THC ranging up to very high concentrations of THC. And some of the high concentrations of THC, you might say, well, how can you justify that for medical purposes? People who can't sleep, for example, will use high concentrations of THC at bedtime in order to help them get to sleep. And I have patients who tell me they haven't slept in 12 years, and now they can sleep using these high concentrations of THC just at bedtime.
How do they feel when they wake up?
If they titrate. And so if they overdo it, then they feel impaired when they wake up. But if they don't, but they'll titrate down so that they can function during the day. And, there are types of cannabis. There's cannabis sativa, which is alerting, and cannabis indica, which is sedating. But I wanted to just say one thing about the addiction part, and that is that that there are studies that have looked at this, and the lifetime risk of addiction using cannabis is 9%. The lifetime risk of addiction to alcohol is probably 25%, and the lifetime risk of addiction to opioids, and I would defer to Tim on this, is probably in the 30% range. Most people believe that adult onset of use in patients who haven't suffered from an addictive disorder and are using it for a medical reason, cannabis for a medical reason, have almost a zero risk of addiction to cannabis.
I have to let you jump in there, Tim. And then I've got a Twitter comment I want to throw to you, Representative the Chance. But go ahead, Tim.
Sure. Well, and I think the adult onset use is important because with substances in general, there's a reason why youth access and youth exposure is so important, because we understand that addiction risk is higher for pretty much any substance you want to talk about
in that developing
among
brain.
Youth and adolescents because of the developing brain. Once you reach the age of 21, it's rare for somebody to take any substance and develop a full-blown addiction had they not had previous experience with addiction as children. Which is why I think as we think about possibly expanding either symptomology framework or what have you, we have to look at how do we make sure that that is narrow enough to still protect those who may be at risk, and that there is clinical assessment work done to ascertain whether or not somebody walking in the door may be at risk when engaging in therapeutic cannabis for an unintended addictive consequence. And again, that gets back to both I have a concern that or is not enough to protect from the kind of diversion tactics we've seen in other states where someone complains of neck pain. It's not based in anything else other than maybe I sprained my back or maybe I didn't and I'm walking in and complaining of neck pain. And what we have is the same kind of drug diversion tactics that we saw with people showing up in emergency rooms claiming about pain to get opiates. So I think we have to think carefully about this as we relate to unintended consequences while, again, trying to protect the rights of the patients for whom this could be clinically indicated.
Well, and when you say or, you're referring to what Representative Chance said earlier. He wants to change New Hampshire's law to say instead of having a symptom and a condition, you would need to have a symptom or a condition, which widens access.
Sure. And I think in the issue of chronic pain, I think there would need to be, for me to feel comfortable with an or, I would need to understand how exactly that chronic pain is going to be ascertained, understand that it is genuine, and that this is indeed an appropriate modality for treatment.
A couple comments on Twitter. Carla says the answer to medical marijuana is to add one more qualifying condition: free will and personal choice. Thanks, Carla, for that one. James on Twitter says marijuana is habitually addicting, not addicting in the same way as heroin or cocaine are addicting. What do you think about that, Representative Chance? Given your personal experience, does marijuana feel addicting to you?
No, it feels relieving for me. It's a miracle. I was addicted to opioids. I know what that addiction feels like. It's not only a mental withdrawal when you do not have that drug. It is a physical withdrawal, sweats, upset stomach. You detox 4 or 5 days when you're on that stuff for 5 years. So I respectfully disagree. And again, I go back to 3% of the population is going to be addicted to something. And I guess if you're that type of person, you could addict yourself to cereal or you could addict yourself to something and eat. Just like an eating disorder. So I just don't believe, from what I read, my studies, marijuana is addicting like some of the other substances that we crave, like alcohol, opioids, the such.
Well, and speaking of research studies, I want to ask all of you, because this keeps coming up all hour. I'm getting a sense from some of you that the research is lacking or you wish you knew more or you'd feel better if there were more research. Dr. Fanciullo, you first, please, because you've looked a lot at this. What's lacking from the research?
Support from the NIH and influence of Big Pharma. I mean, I think are the two biggest problems with all research conducted in the United States. The problem, though, and I'll be brief, is, you know, with looking about asking for more research is these patients are in my office right now and I don't have anything else to offer them. And if we're going to go through the FDA steps of creating these drugs, it's going to take 10 or 20 years. And I don't think we should make our patients wait for 10 or 20 years for a drug that for most people is really safe.
So the research is lacking because, again, we keep saying this, the government considers this a Schedule I illegal drug. But didn't the government recently, Dr. Fanciullo, say that universities could conduct more research?
Yes, they did, and I apologize. I haven't read that data thoroughly, but right now you can get cannabis from only one site, and that's in Mississippi. But I'll defer to Dr. Glassman.
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Glassman.
Sure. Yeah. So when the DEA kept it as a Schedule I, what they also said, and the FDA, what they also said was that they're planning to expand access for research from other locations. That's not in place today. It's going to take a few months to get those other locations up and running, but it should expand the ability for researchers to get research-grade single-strain marijuana, which is what you have to use for research.
What does that mean, single-strain?
In other words, with so many different compounds, THC percentages, CBD, there's hundreds of strains, if that was the old term that was used. If you're going to do research, you have to know what factor X is, and you want to make sure that patients are getting the same thing.
So apples to apples.
Right. Buying stuff off the street, well, you're not going to know what's in there. So obviously research has to be consistent. And the product that you're getting from the federal government, if that's the research, where it's coming from, which was University of Mississippi only, the plan is to expand that access as well.
Go ahead, Tim. What's lacking? What more do we need to know that we don't know now?
Oh, I think I echo both my colleagues with just the need for that FDA-sponsored research. I do think that, and recognize that there's a challenge around very often the FDA process is slow to move. And we've seen that
and
in a whole host of
– Dr. Fanciullo says he has people in pain right now.
Right. And we saw it with – HIV and studies around antiretroviral medications. We've seen it in cancer treatment, particularly on the pediatric side. So I think there needs to be continued – but again, I think that focuses on continued advocacy at the federal level for the Food and Drug Administration to take what is relatively – what is seen as a reputable process to approve medications in this country and fast-track it. And I think that's a place where those who are for and those who are against on all sides of this issue should be coming together a little more and pushing the FDA to go further than what they've done to date so that we can do that research quickly, recognizing the urgency and the expansion of the need to address chronic pain.
Representative Chance, what sorts of studies do you think we need at this point?
You know, I think my colleagues have done a great job explaining it. And for me as a legislator, I look back at the last couple years. I think if we had this show 4 years ago, we might not have all agreed. We might have had some arguments. But I think we all can agree at this table, all of us, no matter what position, that there is some sort of benefit to therapeutic use of cannabis. So with that research, as somebody who introduces bills and goes in front of committees and tries to get this passed, if I had that research, I could make it happen.
Go ahead, Dr. Sure. Glassman.
So this is a thought for the future and potentially another show. So failed back syndrome, addicted to opioids for years. Someone tries to see if they can use medical marijuana to have better relief. If you're working and if you are working in a situation where they do random urine drug testing or you're a commercial truck driver and you test positive for marijuana on that random drug test, you may potentially lose your job because the state laws are not anywhere caught up with where this program is at this point in time. And across the country, state by state, the decisions about judges, about people who tested positive for medical marijuana findings is varied with a flip of a coin. So it's something that really needs to be considered going forward that – because if you look at the diagnoses on this list, they're sick patients who have significant symptoms. The likelihood is they're not working. As you expand access and you bring in people in the work population, one of the consequences will be people are going to test positive. Where are the laws, both for the employer side and the legal side, for that consequence, which is going to happen?
Well, and if that truck driver, took medical marijuana for sleep, Dr. Fanciulla, that you mentioned earlier, woke up, decided that maybe they didn't quite get the dose right, and they're tired, do you really want that person getting in a truck?
I do not. And, it's very arbitrary now, and I agree with Dr. Glassman and everybody else, it's very arbitrary. But if I have a patient who works as a school bus driver who has chronic back pain and wants medical cannabis, I will not attest to the state that they should have medical cannabis. You know, I if somebody's a neurosurgeon, if somebody's a nurse, if somebody has a critical job, I do worry that the cognitive impairment that occurs when you use cannabis can last for up to 72 hours. And so that is a concern of mine as well. And it is a topic for another show probably.
That's fine. We've got 5 days a week to fill. Go ahead, Tim.
I just want to go back to something that Dr. Glassman had said earlier as we think about this question of research, because actually the FDA piece is around how do you bring medications to market to help patients. But he spoke to something else earlier I think is incredibly important on the research side, which is unbiased assessment of the impacts both at a patient and sort of societal and systemic level as you implement a policy such as this in a state.
So don't just look at one person suffering, as terrible as it may be. Look at the broader implications.
Well, again, because I think we could spend another hour about, well, this study said that. Well, my study said this. And, you know, I recall in the early days of this legislation being considered, one of the conversations that came from a colleague of Dr. Glassman's is, could we conceivably have New Hampshire, in essence, become a clinical trial and get FDA approval to use our law as a clinical trial to actually be able to do some of this unbiased assessment, not only around did it work for patients, but was there a consequence in terms of traffic fatalities, diversion of medical marijuana into the community, some of those ancillary things. And that is a piece that I think is really important because there is the patient side of this, the treatment and pain management side, and then again, there is the public health side. And while the addictive rate of THC marijuana might be 9% or 3%, as a public health professional, I don't have the luxury of not caring about that 9 or 3% of the population who are going to develop problems. And we are going to have a system that would meet the needs of those individuals, whether it is through inadvertent access through diverted medical marijuana, someone taking it who has other issues, or a broader policy. So I think that kind of holistic study around the implications of this is equally needed, as well as really deep research around the efficacy and importance of this drug for patients.
So community impacts, not just individual impacts.
I think. And again, I think from an unbiased source, because I think some studies get thrown around, you know, who's funding it? Is pharma funding it? Is the pro-marijuana movement funding it? You know, for the CDC, NIH, and others to do that kind of neutral, unbiased research on both patient outcomes and societal outcomes, I think would be incredibly helpful, particularly if this is going to continue down a road where this is a state policy matter.
Dr. Fanciullo, as a pain doctor who is in support of this, how do you feel about the research? Is it unbiased? Is it funded by, you know, pro-marijuana groups or big pharma or whatever?
So true unbiased research in the pain arena is very rare.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, most of the research that's been done surrounding pain has been done by big pharma. And, you know, the state of New Hampshire is suing one of the pharmaceutical companies right now because of the poor quality of the studies. I totally agree with Tim. I think if we could have an unbiased source of funding and unbiased investigators, that would really help us a lot.
Well, I want everybody to remember the conversation always continues online on Facebook at nhpr.org. And Dr. Fanciullo, Dr. Glassman, Representative LaChance, Tim Work, great to have you all. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Laura.
Thanks so much.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.